Will Menaker, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Of this new right constituency, there's a few different groups that are kind of all lumped in together, right? You have populists, you have this weird neo-monarchist faction, you have conservative social democrats, and Catholics and think they're less influential than the others. What of those groups is the most important current to pay attention to? Like, who is winning this charge? Like, who is leading this movement? What do you think is going to be the decisive shift?
I would say none of them. I think like the only thing that matters is like, you know, the same people who own and can fund the Republican Party since I've been alive. Like,
yeah.
I don't think the neo-monarchist federation of the new right is, I mean, I think they're going to have a good old time. I think they're going to enjoy, having their boy, Donnie T as president. But like, I just don't understand, like, I don't really see like any of these sort of boutique currents of aesthetic philosophical realignment as being anything very important, or I don't know enough about that. I don't have to analyze them, but like I think the conservative movement is still, you know, is going to be dominated by the interests of big business and corporate America and the, you know, military and U.S. military empire.
Yeah.
And I don't think based populism, I don't think based populism is going to have any more purchase in our political system than, you know, let's say the, you know, Bernie Sanders movement in 2020. Kamala Harris is extremely funny too. Just, she's not trying to be. she is... like a living episode of Veep, which is one of the most prophetic television shows of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's very characteristic of our time too, that the reality outpaces the satire.
Right.
Yeah. What do you say when people discuss this online media ecosystem, the influence of comedy, and that it advantages the right more than the left? Do you think that's accurate?
Accurate insofar as, like, you know, if looking at the recent election, like, Donald Trump's media strategy of essentially only doing podcast comedians and sort of like that kind of bro media ecosystem was extremely effective. I don't think it benefits them because I don't think they're funny. Who's the funniest right-wing comedian? I mean, there are comedians that are funny that I think are kind of like de facto associated with the right because they're not liberals. But like, I don't know, like who's the most like? I mean, then again, there aren't that many funny liberal comedians either. it's hard to say. I mean, I think they have certainly capitalized the most off of, you know, this kind of the court jester media system.
Yeah.
The court jester media ecosystem of, you know, people who are like, hey, I'm a dumb guy. I don't know anything about anything, but like, you know, I got my takes and like I have and I'm funny and I'm personable. I think they have been, like I said, I think they have filled that void very ably. And also like back to earlier what I said about like the most lasting effect of Donald Trump is sort of severing in the public consciousness the image of someone who votes Republican as being like a guy who's carried a briefcase to school since he was 11 and wears bow tie. He was like, it's like every time he leaves the house he has a suit on. You know, he has never not worn a tie in public.
Right.
And an addendum to that is the sense that, you know, liberalism has become, you know, somewhat censorious or, you know, school marmish. I mean, I think this is to underrate how literally censorious the right wing is and has always been and will continue to be. But people feel like, oh, like, I can't even laugh anymore. I can't even tell a joke anymore. And I think the right has been obviously the beneficiaries of like I said, being kind of like the Delta House to the Democrats' Omega.
Yeah. I would say there's nothing that structurally advantages the right. They have, I think, an early adopter benefit in that they were sooner to get on alt media platforms, but I don't think that it's impossible to build a productive left media ecosystem.
It's disarming, and it's just it's sort of like going at something, like, especially in terms of political communication, going at something head on. I think people have an instinctive distrust of that, or they feel like they're being sold something, or they feel like you're trying to get over on them. And I think if you can make someone laugh, even if it has nothing to do with the point you're trying to make, I think you've already done the work of getting them to trust you.
So what do we do as people who have a left political commitment to differentiate ourselves from the AOCs of the world? How do we make that clear?
Because don't vote for her.
Don't vote. Okay, that would be one. But for a lot of people who are, right leaning or just apolitical, unsure of where they fall on these issues, maybe they were a Sanders or a Trump guy and they kind of, ping pong back and forth. They see kind of all the stuff that we do as being directly adjacent to bodies in space and whatever that stuff is. So how do we differentiate ourselves from that?
Just in your own words, beliefs, and actions, but I wouldn't do anything on behalf or based on the opinion of I guess what I'm trying to say is that you can't alter your behavior or sort of try to fit yourself into a message based on how you think you're going to be perceived by an imaginary person.
Hmm.
So to someone out there who's doesn't perceive a difference between my politics and that of Joe Biden's or AOC's or whatever, any of these critiques that I'm making that don't mean or matter anything to them. It's just, they don't mean or matter anything to me. So I just have to continue to say what I believe to be true or funny or interesting, and I have to trust the intelligence of anyone who may listen to it to decide for themselves what they think about it. But it's not really a big concern to me an imaginary person will be able to delineate or differentiate these things because I'm not running for office.
I mean, I hear you on that, but this is not part of my questions. It's just my personal political interest. But I've interviewed a lot of people over the last few years who have shifted in their political beliefs. And so I'm very interested in the nodes and the networks and the pathways and the belief systems that they move through. And so trying to anticipate who is actually receptive to this message that maybe doesn't fit within our current analysis of media paradigms, that how do you explain someone who voted for Obama and then Trump and then Bernie or whatever? And so I really want to have a politics that is appealing to basically the mass disenfranchised public, a kind of robust social democratic politics. So I do think about that. I think about how messaging can be accessible and can recruit people.
I don't know. I just saw King Lear with Catherine, Kenneth Branagh, a couple weeks ago. And the last line of that play stuck with me for obvious reasons, but it's when, what's his name? Edgar says, we must bear the weight of these sad times, saying what we feel, not what we ought to say. And I that stuck with me because I just think I don't know what the political package or message that's going to activate the vast majority of, alienated, depoliticized people in this country is. But if you care about something, I think you should say it, and you should say what you believe in honestly and confidently, and trust in, like I said, the intelligence of whoever hears it to connect with it, or that if you have faith that what you believe in is right, I think you should practice that faith by expressing yourself and believing that the rightness of what you believe in will in some way connect find purchase in a larger consciousness.
I mean, I feel a similar way where as the election results came in, it was just, okay, the gloves are off. I'm not going to hold back anything that I think now. There's no reason to be on good behavior. The Death Star is blown up, It's every man for himself now. I met recently with a friend of mine who's involved in the labor movement. And one of the things that her colleagues were speculating on is that Trump will fulfill this promise to reshore industry by bringing back solar and wind, building it in the U.S. exclusively with ununionized labor.
Doesn't Donald Trump hate wind and solar energy, though?
He does, but I think he hates it less than he hates China.
Okay.
And that would be the bare minimum fulfillment.
Well, I suppose that's a good thing, you know. So I guess it's not all bad. But then you said doing it without union labor. I mean, what do your friends in labor think about this?
I mean, they think it's devastating.
Yeah.
They think it'll be really bad.
Okay.
Yeah. Joe Biden on his way out gave I believe, quote, full and unconditional pardon to Hunter Biden for crimes committed between, if I remember correctly, January 1st of 2014 and December 30th of 2024. You know, full 10-year arc to commit as many crimes as you want. Did this damage faith in the Democratic Party in any way?
No, I think it's one of the few things they've done that actually to buoy people's faith in the Democratic Party. No, I mean, for the Hunter Biden thing is like, it's funny, but like, not as significant to me as some of the other pardons that Biden has done on the way out, like that judge in Pennsylvania who was taking money to just like ruin the like hundreds, if not thousands, of like teens that were put in these like, you know, just shunted into like for money into like, you know, private disciplinary institutions. But as far as Hunter goes, I don't know. Like, I guess I have an affection for Hunter Biden because he's like someone who doesn't really have any ambition to do anything other than just like have fun, shall we say? which is like I think much better for the children of, you know, wealth and privilege than to like, I don't know, want to be president himself.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a fair point that, you know, people who have access to wealth and can just kind of retire at age 24, like, what else do you want to do other than hang out? Maybe that's better than getting involved in Burisma or whatever the hell he was doing. Speaking of Ukraine, how do you expect Trump to interact with Ukraine? Do you expect him to withdraw funding? Do you think he'll fulfill his promises to
that's
bring a conclusion
yeah.
to the war?
I don't know, but I really don't know. But like, that's an interesting question. I'm interested to see what, like, my instinct, like, if I had to bet on it, my bet would be that he doesn't cut off funding for Ukraine.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a project that's just too embedded in the national security state, empire, whatever you want to call it. I think it's just they're pot committed there to try to bleed Russia dry to the last Ukrainian alive. And
so we've conscripted every teenager in the entire country.
Well, yeah, so arrest them in Pennsylvania and send them to Kiev. No, but that's an interesting question, like in terms of like, will Trump govern differently than like, I don't know, Marco Rubio or Jeb
sure.
Bush would? I don't know what to expect. It's I'm interested to find out though. But my instinct is such that they will leave the military aid and like support for this continuing this proxy war. I think they will leave that. But I'm willing to be surprised, as I am in all things in life.
Well, we do also have another very expensive war to fund. Which has been going on with tremendous success under Joe Biden. There seems to be, you're kind of zooming out here a little bit, but there seems to be a breakdown of institutional trust and legitimacy that is happening basically across the U.S., but also across the globe, where I think of the ICC, I think of all of these condemnations of what Israel is doing, and it just falls on deaf ears, or the United States government is not interested to respond to it in any way. We also have this unconditional pardon for Hunter Biden, and we have, importantly, a Trump felony conviction for the hush payments to Stormy Daniels. And it seems that in the eyes of both of these constituencies, Trump's base was entirely unaffected by this felony conviction, you know? And they told us that this would prevent him from getting elected. People will see him as
great.
A criminal. and it's just like, people don't care.
No, like, I mean,
people
like,
don't care.
People don't care. And like, I mean, his supporters, they like him even more from it because it's like, you know, Trump's a gangster. He's got a felony conviction, you know?
right.
But
right.
No, it was, and I don't credit myself for with too powerful an insight or a prophetic vision or whatever. But like, I knew from the jump, like, just like, again, once again, I think the Democrats were trying to run a re-election based on like, we don't even have to campaign against Donald Trump because he's going to be a convicted felon.
Right.
And like that alone is just like that will do the work for us. But I guess it was just like, I knew that was a doomed from the beginning because I don't think people cared. And to the extent like, it's just, you can't, you have to run against him. You have to run against the man. And you can't just run against him by being like, he's a crook or a criminal, because I think everyone assumes politicians are crooked, corrupt, and criminal.
Right.
But it's just a question of like, are they on your side, whether you perceive them as being crooked on your side,
right,
or on the behalf of special interests that you hate, even if you don't really like, you can't really name them or like, point a finger at them. So yeah, I thought it was especially funny to, that his felony convictions didn't move a single vote.
You mentioned this consensus before. What held it together, let's say, 10, 20, 40 years ago, whenever it was, you know, relatively less fragmented than it is now?
I think a mix of economic conditions and also like the I think what's led to this breakdown is both like the economic crash, the war on terror, like, you know, ushering in the 21st century with 9/11, and just seeing like, you know, a previously unimaginable event occurring, and now it has to be, now it is not just imaginable but real. And that, like, it seems to announce a kind of a new reality, and that the previous one was insufficient. And then I think our government and our society's reaction to 9/11, both in plunging this country now into like more or less a, you know, well, like I said, plunging, we've kind of like, since 1948 or since the end of World War II, we've more or less been at a state of war constantly,
yeah,
or at least have built up a military budget that would commensurate with a country being literally invaded. Yeah. And it's only gotten bigger. I think the economic crash, and also just like the exponential development of technology, and particularly the internet and social media has accelerated the inability of a consensus reality to corral, cajole, or contain the weirdness that's out there, and that everybody perceives and feels, and like, even if they can't quite put a name on it, I think the media's like ability or utility, and it's, like I said, in kind of crafting an official narrative, or I don't know, like closing Pandora's box or whatever. I think because of both, you know, like right in front of our faces, the legitimacy of our leaders and the media institutions who we're supposed to trust and believe in, more or less, like, you know, like fall apart in front of our eyes, but also just the world itself. It seems like it's getting weirder and more out of control. And like, whether that's true or not doesn't really matter, because I personally think that like human history has always been weird and completely out of control.
Yeah, you had mentioned before that this consensus reality was supported by certain economic conditions, one of which may have been the military Keynesianism that you uh-huh. described before, that essentially the state would pump money into producing weapons that were manufactured throughout all these different states and support people, win their votes, and so on. If we can spend it on weapons, we could certainly spend it on climate, God forbid. And previously, you mentioned that the boomer vote was the only place in which the Democrats made progress. These are people for whom the consensus narrative is still holding together. Is it possible, within the framework of liberalism, to create that post-war boom prosperity that we had that sustained this consensus reality? Is it at all possible to get back to there?
I mean,
because the profit margins of that time were just enormous, you know, and plausibly speaking, like, capitalism, liberal democracy was working well for working people of that period. Unprecedented upward mobility growing up in tenement buildings, moving to the suburbs, things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's like the GI Bill, like, you know, is like provided you, you know, a specific, you know, tranche of the American public, like, you know, mostly white, but men, but like, it was probably one of the most successful social welfare programs in human history. And along with that, the U.S. public education system, and like a lot of things. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not savvy enough, or I don't know enough like policy to like give you any good reason why we simply can't go back to that. To me, it was just simply a matter of what you just how you direct and marshal the productive forces and resources of the wealthiest country in human history. And I think like the fact that we've done it in the past, it should be an indication that there's no reason we can't do it again. But like that would have to. It's like, you know, turning around an oil tanker in the Suez Canal at this point. It's just, right. Our entire political system seems dedicated to preventing that from happening. And by that happening, I mean, like, you know, the redistribution of the wealth of our society to the people who produce it and the people who would most benefit from it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've made a similar turn in the last few years where I used to, you know, make these impassioned defenses of institutions and criticisms of platforms and things like this. But I really feel, just very broadly speaking, that the institutions that exist today are probably beyond saving, that it is a more worthwhile task for just the total amount of hours you're going to spend into trying to steer the ship out of the Suez Canal, you might as well build something new at this point. And so, yeah, I don't have a lot of faith for them. So we're not in a good period for revolution by any stretch of the imagination. We're not even in a good period for reform. And for people who have political convictions, these are, you know, immensely frustrating years. It would be maybe hard to say that we've been through worse periods within our lifetimes. I think this is going to be a real valley in the next coming years. And during that, you have to be able to maintain your faith in the program, in your beliefs. You have to stay sane. How do people do that during these really terrible times? How do you keep the faith, keep yourself sane, not abandon hope for your politics?
I'd begin with, I don't know, just trying to like fix your own beliefs or life in like a larger historical context, particularly if you are consider yourself on the left of the victories are, you know, few and far between, and you have to just kind of like get used to losing or losing well, because it's gonna keep happening, and you know the odds are not in your favor. But I mean, I think, I mean, the realer point is just to stay connected to people, to stay connected to real people in your life. You know, not, I mean, online is one thing, and I'm not trying to say, oh, like everything online is fake. It's not real life. But I mean, just to stay engaged with your own goals, and also connected to like to be of service or to be involved in the lives of people, in the lives of those who are important to you. And to understand, I don't know, to just kind of like be a little bit stoic about it, and just to understand that like nobody is as happy or as miserable as they imagine themselves to be, nor is any period in time as utopian or apocalyptic as you may feel it. I think just the key is to try to stay, just try to be an active part of, like, to be active in one's own life, and to just to try to fight as hard as possible against passivity and becoming sort of a passive observer, not just of the times you live in, but of your own life passing time. And I think, like, you know, like that's, I mean, like, you know, like that's just like the way to understand depression, almost. Like, depression to me is a feeling of passivity in your own life. And I think the only way to counteract that, be it like sort of a broader political malaise and sense of hopelessness, or just a personal one, is to try in any way possible to fight against passivity and to be an active participant in one's own life. And I think the way you do that is by being an active participant in the lives of others, of being helpful or useful or just doing something that connects you or just sort of is of use to the people around you.